From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Is there any animal with a more glorious life than a queen ant, ruling over a colony of a million ants, every one her own daughter? And is there any creature with a more miserable existence than a male drone?
They're built for only one thing. They're winged, sperm-carrying missiles that mate once with a queen. The males are distinctively, how shall I put it, handicapped in many ways. They have smaller brains, and they don't do any work. They just sit there waiting for the big moment, which is that flight out in the air and one mating maybe, and the majority usually don't mate at all. And then what do the males do? They do what they're supposed to do. They die.
That's E.O. Wilson, the renowned Ant-Man from Harvard, who will join us later this hour. Today we'll explore the idea of the hive mind, from the social organization of ants to the swarm intelligence that shapes human behavior, to the dangers of our overly connected digital world.
When we turn the switch inside ourselves and turn into a member of a mob, we behave worse. And this is exactly what you see all the time online when people get testier and nastier than they ever would otherwise. We're turning the switch and we're eliciting mob behavior.
So, if you're going to do a radio show about hive mind, where do you start? Oh, bees, of course. Honeybees, to be precise. Their hives are some of the most remarkable and complex systems of social organization on the planet. Steve Paulson talked with Cornell biologist Thomas Seeley about this remarkable insect.
I have to say it's hard to understand how 10,000 bees can somehow work together and live together in a single colony and coordinate all their activities. How do they all know what to do?
Yes, that is the puzzle. You've got 10,000 or 20,000 or 30,000 individuals working together. Their interests are aligned, so it's not like some are trying to do one thing and others are trying to do another. They all have the common interest of trying to make the group or colony work well. But that still leaves you with the question is, how do they actually implement that? How do they pull it off? One thing's really clear. The queen is not a leader. She's not issuing orders of what to do. She's very important. She's the genetic heart of the colony, but she's not a central decision maker or a central leader of the colony. So how do they do it? Well, each bee is largely an independent agent. Each bee has to go around, collect information for herself about what to do and how to do it.
You said for herself. So these bees are mainly female?
We're talking about the workers, and all of the workers in a bee colony are females. The colony is a family, and these workers are the daughters of the queen, and the males, or drones as they're called, are the sons of the queen.
So you have these tens of thousands of bees. Somehow they all know what they're supposed to do.
Right. They do organize their work in the sense that they do different things at different points during their lives. The first third of its life, it's working primarily in the center of the hive where the brood is being reared. So it concentrates on the tasks associated with feeding the brood, tending the queen, keeping her clean and well-fed, keeping the center of the nest, which is like an incubator, keeping that warm. During the second third of their life, they move out of the heart of the nest to the edge of the nest, where they concentrate on handling the food, actually making the honey. And then the last third of their lives, these workers work outside the hive. They're the foragers, going out and collecting the nectar and the pollen that sustain the life of a colony.
Hmm. But now, are these bees constantly communicating with each other? I mean, do they have chemical signals they're passing on to each other?
Yes and no. They do have a lot of signals. The very famous ones are the ones used by the foragers, the waggle dance, to share information about food sources outside the hive. But much of the information doesn't even come through signals. It comes through a process of individuals paying attention to cues in the environment, such as, let's take, for example, the nurse bees working in the heart of the nest. Nobody has to tell an individual nurse bee when to produce heat or not. Each bee just senses for herself if her own little microenvironment around her, or if the larvae that she's tending are cool, that in itself tells her she should be producing some heat.
Now, there are some spectacular displays that bees are famous for. You mentioned the waggle dance.
Mm-hmm.
What happens there?
It's the most famous of the signals of the honeybee. It's one where a bee performs a behavior where she basically produces a miniaturized reenactment of the flight out to a source of food. But instead of flying out to the food outside the hive, she walks across the comb inside the hive, flapping her wings, buzzing the wings. She uses the flight muscles without moving the wings to make a buzzing or high-pitched sound. And when she does this waggle dance, she will do what we call a waggle run across the comb. And the duration of that waggle run, how long that lasts, and it can be 1 second or it can be 5 seconds or 10 seconds, is an indication of how far the flight is. So she basically compresses a flight that might take 10 minutes down to a flight that takes maybe 10 seconds.
So you're saying that she's communicating all kinds of information within just a few seconds.
That's right. She's in particular, she's indicating the direction to the flowers that she's found and also the distance to the flowers that she's found.
So it's not as if then she's going back out and leading bees to where this was, or does she do that too?
No, that's an important point. This has been checked very carefully. The successful forager does not directly lead the bees out. She's abstractly expressing the information about the distance and direction. Others are getting that information from her, and then independently, on their own time, they're leaving the hive and using that information.
That's amazing.
It's particularly amazing when you think about the dimensions involved. First, the dimension of a bee. A bee is, what, maybe 3/4 of an inch long? And the distances over which the bee is traveling outside the hive are miles. These bees can range up to 3, 4, 5 miles from the hive.
Now, one thing I'm curious about is, how do you, as a bee biologist, actually see all of this? I mean, these are tiny little creatures. How do you actually isolate what individual bees do?
The main tool that we use that makes all of this possible is the observation hive. That is to say, it's a hive where we, instead of having wooden sides on the hive, we provide glass walls on the side of the hive. And we also use the, instead of a big white box like you would see a beekeeper's hives, it's very thin. In fact, it has just one layer of combs in it, so you can see all of the activities inside the hive. So that lets you peer inside, and thank goodness the bees don't mind having light shining inside their nests. But then to actually track individuals to see what they're really doing, what's really helpful is to be able to label individuals, and sometimes we'll set up a colony where all... we might have 4,000 bees labeled for individual identification.
You've actually tagged all the individual bees?
Right. You put a little plastic tag on the thorax of each bee, and that'll give you 100 different combinations or 500 different combinations, and then you put paint marks on the abdomen to get you up into the thousands.
So how do you do that?
It involves chilling the bees and painstakingly labeling one bee at a time. And once you've done that, then, of course, it's no longer a situation of anonymous bees. Each bee is an individual.
Now, isn't there another kind of behavior where bees have to figure out where to build the nest in the first place?
That's right. Yeah, that's actually one of the most remarkable pieces of their biology, and it's one we're just working out right now. It's how these bees, in the spring, when a colony goes through a process called swarming, the colony divides itself, where the mother queen leaves with about half of the workers. They don't fly very far from their original home, but they maybe 100 feet, and they'll form a cluster of bees. It looks about the size of a soccer ball, and this will hang from a tree branch. You've got about 10,000 bees and one queen bee. They're faced with the challenge of finding a new home, a new hollow tree, for example.
And how do they go about doing that?
About 3% of those 10,000 bees function as scout bees, and they will comb the surrounding woods. And the individuals that find prospective home sites, tree cavities, will come back and use the same waggle dance that we were talking about before to announce their discoveries. And bees that, and here's where it really gets interesting. You might have 24 or so potential home sites being advertised by different bees on the surface of the swarm. And somehow they have to choose they have to work it out because they only need one and they want to find which one, they want to move into whichever is the best. It's an intriguing question of how you can organize a group so that it's good at making decisions. In a nutshell, what we find is that each bee adjusts the amount or the strength of her dance in accordance with the goodness of the potential home site that she's found. So if she finds a spectacular site, she'll come back to the swarm and dance for maybe 10 minutes. If she finds only a so-so site, when she comes back and does a dance, it may only last for a minute.
You don't get false advertising? One bee that comes back and basically is saying, I got a really good site, but it's actually so-so?
It's pretty rare, but occasionally you do see bees that come back and dance very vigorously for what we know is only a mediocre site. But that's an error that doesn't propagate. She might have good success in recruiting other bees to that site, but those bees go out and independently assess the site, and they will only dance if they judge that it's a good site. And so they very rarely would a second bee make that same mistake, and so the error wouldn't be propagated.
Well, it's fascinating to think about this as a model for decision-making. I mean, somehow all of these different individuals come together and make a group decision that's good for the whole through this process of cooperative competition. Can we learn anything from bees?
Well, actually, I think we can learn some things from the bees. And these are things that I call swarm smarts. These are lessons, at least, that I've taken away from the bees. One is that if you're in a group, a committee, say, or a faculty meeting of an academic department, and you're facing a difficult decision, or one thing you can do, which the bees show us, is that step one is to make sure you explore your options broadly. In other words, tap into the diverse knowledge of the people within the group. Don't stifle people early on, call it a brainstorming phase of the meeting, or go around the room and say, what ideas do people have? And that's what the bees do. They let lots of scouts go out, search on their own, and come back and report freely what they have found. So that's one thing the bees do well that we can learn from. Another is that once you've got your options on the table, make sure that individuals vote independently. If you don't have that independence among individuals, the ultimate decision tends to drift in the favor of maybe the more powerful or more higher status individual in the group. And that's certainly what the bees do. Each bee votes by going to the sites that she's interested in, and each one decides for herself. No bee goes to a site just because she sees other bees going to it. The way we can do that in human groups is you can have secret ballots. Instead of having a vote where people raise their hand and look around at what others are voting, they make their vote quietly and discreetly.
Thomas Seeley is a professor of neurobiology and behavior at Cornell University. He talked with Steve Paulson. Now, we wanted to give you a more visceral sense of what bees are like. So a while back, we sent one of our interns, John Peterson, to visit a local beekeeper, Mary Seeley. John arrived, microphone in hand, the day she was setting up some new hives. And I should add that this is one assignment none of our paid staff would take on.
I got bees crawling on my skin here.
Oh, yeah, he's scared.
Okay.
If you just shake your arm, they should fall off. Shake your...
They're okay. I think they're not stinging
yet. Beekeeper in the making. Most people don't like insects crawling on them.
Well, I can't say I'm...
You're the exception to the rule.
Just trying to be a good sport, I guess.
You are.
So, it's kind of hard to believe I'm just sitting here. There's probably about... How many bees are in one of these boxes?
Well, there's about 8,000.
About 8,000. Uh-huh. I like my hair.
It's black. They think it's a bear's nose, so...
They think I'm a bear's nose?
Yeah. Do you have black on your earphones?
Oh...
So see her, she's in their cage. So I always just check to make sure she's alive.
There's the queen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. She's alive. Put her in the center. The bees can get at her and feed her. Okay, I'm gonna dump them in.
Here we go. Are you going to give me a head net or something?
Yeah, do you need one?
Well,
you're pretty brave, Dad. I'll give you a lot of credit.
See, if I stay calm, they won't bite me, right?
Start a new life. Oh my gosh, my back.
Thank you.
Thanks to John Peterson for going above and beyond the call of duty. When we come back, we'll hear about the science of swarm intelligence and what it means for us. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Can we learn anything from bees? Or from birds or ants, for that matter? Science writer Len Fisher says the study of social animals can tell us a great deal about human behavior. Fisher's written a book called The Perfect Swarm, The Science of Complexity in Everyday Life. He told Ann Strange Champs that many animals use the principles of swarm intelligence. So what is swarm intelligence? It's the idea that the group has its own collective wisdom, which is greater than the combined smarts of all the individual members.
Like when you get a flock of birds flying, for example, you see the whole flock moving as one. And people used to think that birds probably had ESP, and extrasensory perception, because they could all communicate with each other and all move as one. What we now know is that they're moving like that just because each bird is following simple rules of interaction with its neighbours. You know, keep up with the bird in front, keep along the bird alongside, and keep in the general direction of the flock without bashing into anybody. And those three rules are sufficient to lead this amazingly complex behavior of the group as a whole. So that's swarm intelligence in the natural world.
And does swarm intelligence apply mostly to animals? I mean, I'm thinking of birds, fish, ants, but does it also apply to people?
Well, that sort of swarm intelligence, where we're interacting with our neighbours and things build up into a pattern, you see in the streets, if you go out into a crowded street, you see something remarkable happening when the crowd density gets sufficiently high, and that is that the crowd suddenly breaks into rivers. So you have a river of pedestrians going in one direction, a river of pedestrians coming in the other direction. It's a very efficient way of moving, but nobody's told them to do this. It just happens spontaneously.
What do you think causes this? Is this evolved, learned behavior? Is it hardwired in our DNA by now? Are we picking up on subtle cues that we don't even realize we recognize?
No, it's nothing to do with psychology. It's everything to do with physics. It's not something that's thought out. It's not something that's psychological. It's something that just happens. There was a wonderful experiment with some students. What they did was take a big circle, and the students were told just to walk around at random in this circle, just keeping within arm's length of each other. Now, around the outside of the circle, there was a series of cards, A, B, C, etc. And what the students didn't know is just a couple of their number had been told to walk around it more or less at random, but to make sure that they ended up next to the letter J. So after 10 minutes, these students who had been told ended up next to the letter J, and so did almost every other student, the ones that knew were there. Invisible leaders. It's amazing what you can do with that concept when you really start to think about it.
Yeah, I think the non-scientific way of putting that is people are sheep.
Well, not necessarily so. It's just that if they were told to keep within arm's length to each other, and there were a few that were heading in a different direction, that effect rippled through the whole group to take them all.
So how far could you extrapolate from that study to human behavior? Because it's very slightly frightening, suggesting that we're all more susceptible to invisible leadership than we might assume.
Well, we are. But I mean, you can take these parallels with the animal kingdom just so far. We are individuals. And if we can find some way of packaging our individual intelligence and our individual understanding to get it together so that it generates decision-making in the group as a whole, then that's a very good thing. And there's a number of ways to go about that.
For instance?
Well, one of the very simple ways is to take an average opinion of the group. And there's a classic experiment. I'll give you the simple experiment, which has been repeatedly done, is you take a big jar full of jelly beans and ask a group of people to guess how many jelly beans there might be in the jar. Now, you get a whole wide range of guesses, but the remarkable thing is when you take the average of those guesses, and I say this has been proved again and again, that average turns out to be a lot closer to the right answer than almost all of the individual guesses within the group.
Well, so that's an example of, you know, the phenomenon we talk about, the wisdom of crowds, the idea that a decision based on what most people think is going to be better than what any single individual thinks. But then we also talk about the dangers of groupthink.
That's absolutely true. And the vital difference between the two is independence, because the only way in which this swarm intelligence, this group intelligence, can work effectively is if people are able to take individual judgments before they put them together without being affected by what other people think. So I've tried that jelly bean experiment myself in a group where I said to the people, why don't you talk among yourselves and try and work out what the best one is? Well, they were influencing each other, and of course you had one strong character who was very insistent, so they all ended up pretty close to the one strong character's guess, which was miles away. And you can take this, you know, a long, long way. There's some rather worrying thoughts about it. One thought that I've had for myself, and I've not seen this studied, is in the performance of juries. Because you think the jury system, yes, that's a very, very democratic way of coming to a decision in a case, which can affect somebody's life very, very strongly. But in fact, when you look at the way that juries work, juries are very susceptible to groupthink. They're very susceptible through talking about the case, which has its advantages. You can say, hey, you know, here are the main points, and let's all bring in our own main points and try to discuss them rationally.
But there are often cases where there is that one strong individual in a jury who really pushes an agenda one way or the other. And then, of course, juries are sequestered, so it's very difficult for anybody to pull out and go think independently.
Absolutely. Now, there is a logical way around it, but it may not be a very practical way. And the logical way is for each juror to hear the case and make their mind up independently before they start talking with the other jurors. Now, how easy that would be to set up in our present society, I simply don't know.
Are there any other kind of practical uses to this science of complexity and swarm intelligence? I mean, are there principles you've pulled out that you use in everyday life?
One of the simplest, I think, is in making decisions for yourself. It turns out that just very simple rules, like if you've got a choice between two things and you recognize one of them, that's the one you go with.
Sort of like going with your first guess or the thing that seems the most familiar.
It is. But some people in Germany put their own money on the line when they came up with this. What they did was they went out into the street with a list of the companies who were on the stock market, the German stock market, and they showed this list to people and asked them which ones they recognized. And on the basis of that, they invested in the 10 companies which were most recognized, and they got a 45% return in the first year.
Whoa.
So
yes, I'd say it's a very, very practical application.
Well, I'm going off the point of swarm intelligence a little bit, but one that I really like is in choosing your life partner. Because if you work out how many likely people that you might meet, which ones are you going to choose? Do you choose the first person who feels like a really good partner? Or do you think, okay, maybe I should just hang on and see if I meet somebody else, which is what we advise our kids to do. But how long should you hang on? And there's a way of doing it, a mathematical way of doing it, which is equally relevant to shopping in markets.
I guess it's a kind of shopping.
Well, roughly speaking, work out how many chances you're going to get. Like if you're shopping in a market, there might be 100 shops with the thing you're looking for, and you're looking for the best price. Do you look in all those 100 shops? And apart from all the effort involved, you might find out that you've looked in all of them and gone back, and then the first one's been sold, so you've lost out. Or do you just take the first bargain that you find? The answer is that you look at one-third of the total possibilities and then choose the next one that's better than any of those.
that... It comes down to that precise a mathematical formula?
Why, oh, it does. In fact, when I... When I say one-third, it comes out as the number pi, 1 over pi.
Oh, the mystical pi.
The mystical pi. Yeah, in theory, you could use the same sort of thing with the life partner. Okay, maybe I'm going to meet 100 people that I would really, maybe, want to get on with. But once I've rejected one, I'm not going to be able to go back to them. They'll be with somebody else. So what am I going to do? And the answer is, if you've got the courage and if you believe in mathematics and if you're willing to use mathematics to rule your life, is to wait until you've met 30-odd people out of the 100, and then the next one that you find who's at least as nice or good or wonderful as any of those, that's the person. Now, unfortunately...
And is this how this you selected your life partner?
Yeah, but this mathematics doesn't work. It works for shopping. It doesn't work for life partners because the other person's also got a choice. When you buy a dishwasher, it doesn't choose you. But if you choose somebody, it might well be that they haven't chosen you.
Yes.
And so it sort of falls down there. But it's an interesting way of thinking about it.
Len Fisher joined us from Sydney, Australia. His book is called The Perfect Swarm, The Science of Complexity in Everyday Life. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Suppose a group has a million, or even 10 million members. Could they possibly work together without collapsing into total chaos? Well, they can, if they're part of an ant colony. This is why scientists describe certain species of ants as superorganisms, because the colony itself often acts as if it's one giant animal. So how do ants do it? That's the question that biologists E.O. Wilson and Bert Holdobler explore in a book called The Superorganism. Wilson is an eminent Harvard biologist who may know more about ants than any other person on Earth. Steve Paulson talked with E.O. Wilson about the marvels of the ant world.
How big are the biggest colonies of social insects?
They range from as few as 10 individuals all the way up to... it's believed in excess of 20 million in the driver ants of Africa. And mind you, those 20 million are all daughters of a single mother ant.
That's phenomenal. 20 million children of one queen. That's
mother of the year, hands down.
So how big a territory, just in terms of actual geographical space, would this 20 million ant colony extend over?
They march at frequent intervals, the driver ants of Africa. And I don't think it's that they defend the territory, but they're constantly on the move. The same is true of the army ants, which are almost up in that class of hugeness. They have upwards of a million. And they don't really have territories. They avoid each other. And as they sweep along with these daily raids, catching everything they can get their mandibles on, they clean out the area of small creatures, grasshoppers, other ants, even small mice, if they can catch them, and so on, to the extent that when an army ant colony or a driver ant colony, either one, comes through, then it leaves behind a relatively barren area.
Hmm. Now, there are some other giant colonies of ants, I mean, of different species, that are more sedentary. Isn't the leafcutter ant like that?
Yeah, these are what we call the ultimate superorganisms because they build gigantic nests and further are able to build the immense populations, which go to over 3 million, maybe as high as 5 million in some cases, again, daughters of a single queen, by using fresh vegetation. They're the only creature we know that can harvest fresh vegetation and use it, not to eat it directly, but by using it as a substrate to raise fungi. And in that way, it is a true agriculturist.
You're saying they're actually farmers growing this stuff.
They are farmers.
So how, I mean, what boggles the mind is how you could have so many ants, I mean millions of ants in a single colony, how you could organize all of those organisms.
That's what Bert Holdobler and I have spent our scientific lifetimes unraveling. In the case of the super organism, the leafcutter ants, there are a graded series of casts of different sizes, and they have different shapes to their heads. They have different, you know, size of glands that they use to communicate with, and they have very different functions. As you go from little guys, which are, they may be one or a half a millimeter across the head, all the way up to giants with heads 5 to 6 millimeters. The little guys in these leafcutter colonies are the gardeners. They are the ones that take intimate care of the fungus that's growing on which the colony depends for food. And then up around the middle size, say their heads are about 2 millimeters across, you have the ones that come out, the foragers. They're the ones you mostly see out on these long trails through the rainforest and grasslands of the tropics. They go and find the plants and then cut the leaves, scissor off pieces of leaves that they can carry back to the nest. And there are a number of sizes in between that size and the smallest that perform the functions of preparing the fresh leaves or fresh flowers sometimes they bring in. They have to be chewed into a pulp by these intermediate-sized ants.
Now, presumably, they have to communicate with each other, don't they? Sort of.
They do.
To tell each other what they're doing?
Well, let me tell you about the giants first.
Okay.
When you go up to those huge guys, they have grotesquely large heads. And these are large because they are packed with muscles that pull almost razor-sharp mandibles together. And it's our belief that, we know they're defensive. That's a defensive cast. But it appears that they're defenders especially against, guess what? Anteaters. Hmm. And other larger animals that could invade the nest.
So presumably all these ants, these millions of ants, have to somehow talk to each other. They have to tell each other what they're doing. How do they do that?
It was only the 1960s that we began to work that out. They talk almost exclusively, let's say 95% plus, by pheromones, by chemical substances that they release from their bodies. And you know they have glands all up and down their bodies from the tip of their heads way back to the tip of the last segment on their body that are used in communication. And these signals can be combined. They can be modulated in terms of where they are released to give different meanings. And the ants build up quite a vocabulary just by smelling and tasting each other.
What are some of the different kinds of signals they might emit?
Start with alarm substances. If you disturb, let's go back to our leafcutter ants. If you go back to, say, the surface of these huge nests they build, and the nest may be 10 meters across, and they go down 8 meters into the soil, they'll be swarming with the ants or columns coming and going. If you disturb them badly, just stir them around and push them around, they release from glands in their heads an alarm substance. Then the ants are alarmed. They go into a little frenzy or very excited, running about looking for an enemy. So then they'll converge on that spot. Another pheromone is the trail substance. And it's chemicals, pheromones, that are laid down and pass from the nest where the ants are to objects far away. These objects can be food that someone has just discovered in the colony. It can be an enemy that seems to be approaching. It has the effect not just of guiding the other ants in, it has the effect of exciting them.
Hmm. Now, in terms of all these worker ants, and in some cases these millions of ants that might live in one colony, what sex are they?
They're all female.
All females.
Oh, yes. Believe me, this is liberalism run amok.
There are just a few males who are around to mate, and then once they've done their business, they leave or they die?
Oh, yes. There have to be males, you know, to have a mixture of genes and keep strength up of adaptability of the the next generation of colonies. But these males, they're built for only one thing. They're winged, sperm-carrying missiles that mate once with a queen, a virgin queen. When the colony releases simultaneously at the appropriate year, part of the year, these swarms of virgin queens that are going to start the new colonies, and the males with them, swarms of males that mate with them. The males are distinctively, how shall I put it, handicapped in many ways. They have smaller brains. They have huge eyes, which help orient when they go out looking for a queen. They have tiny mandible jaws, almost no jaws at all in many cases. They have to be fed by their sisters, and they don't do any work. They just sit there waiting for the big moment, which is that flight out in the air and, you know, one mating maybe, and the majority usually don't mate at all. And then what do the males do? They do what they're supposed to do. They die. They can't go back to the nest. The queen, they would just be driven away. They're mostly going to be quickly picked up by birds and lizards and other ants and so on. Few males last more than a day or two. I'm sorry if this, you know, this is disturbing.
It's kind of a dismal news. Life, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you just don't want to be a male. However, if you're a queen, now that's a different matter. If you're one of these young queens, you know, which has a few minutes of excitement in the air, she settles down. And we have records now of queen ants that started a colony. They lay eggs, you know, raise their first brood of workers, their daughters, first brood of daughters. And they start the colony, and that grows and grows and grows. And then finally it reaches a size after a few years. In some cases, like the fire ant, within 1 year, they're producing new queens and ready to breed or to reproduce themselves as a colony. But some queens, in extreme cases, have been recorded as living over 20 years. They're the oldest insects in the world that we know of.
That's entomologist E.O. Wilson talking with Steve Paulson. Wilson's the co-author with Bert Holdobler of the book The Superorganism.
Just what makes that little old ant think he'll move that rubber tree plant? Anyone knows an ant can't move a rubber tree plant, but he's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. He's got high apple pie in the sky hopes. So anytime you're getting low, instead of letting go, just remember that ant. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree.
Coming up, we'll hear why computer pioneer Jaron Lanier has soured on the hive mind, or at least the way it's evolved in digital technology. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The idea of hive mind has entered the popular lexicon, and it's a touchstone in discussions about social insects and artificial intelligence and science fiction.
The Borg are a massive organization of beings abducted from other species, each genetically and cybernetically altered to serve the collective at large as drones. Being wholly robbed of any sense of individuality, the billions, perhaps trillions of Borg drones operate as a hive mind. All thoughts are only those of the collective. The society is analogous to an insect colony with a queen at the apex of the hierarchy. The Borg have spread their influence into all four quadrants of the Milky Way and beyond, into nearby galactic clusters and even transdimensional realms in their pursuit of new technologies and resources, often destroying entire civilizations in their wake.
Well, the Borg was an especially frightening idea in Star Trek. The hive mind is scaring some people in our own high-tech world. Surprisingly, one is Jaron Lanier. He's been a pioneer in developing new technologies. In fact, he popularized the phrase virtual reality back in the 80s. But he's come to believe that Web 2.0 technology is promoting a kind of digital Maoism. And he thinks it's actually limiting our choices and even erasing the sense of our own individuality. Lanier lays out his critique in a book called You Are Not a Gadget. Anne Strangechamps talked with Jaron Lanier.
You've been very critical of what's called hive mind. It's called a lot of other things, too. But what exactly is it that you don't like about the emerging hive mind?
Well, there are a few things not to like. One problem is that when you ask people to act as part of a hive, you bring out bad behavior in people. I think there's a switch in the human spirit, and it also exists in all sorts of other creatures that evolve to be either singular or group members. And when we turn the switch inside ourselves and turn into a member of a mob, we behave worse. And this is exactly what you see all the time online when people get testier and nastier than they ever would otherwise. We're turning the switch and we're eliciting mob behavior. And it's an ugly thing to do.
Let's follow up just on that one point there. So when you say people are getting uglier and becoming a mob, can you point to some examples?
Sure. Look at the comments under a YouTube video and you'll see a kind of incivility that has no purpose, no incitement other than the design itself, which is asking people to interact with each other in a way that has no consequence whatsoever other than people trying to avoid being the one who's ridiculed at the moment. It's just like being a member of a gang for a moment.
So you're saying there's a kind of culture of sadism that's emerging?
I'm afraid that is the right word. We have our own vocabulary for sadism. We call it trolling. But yes, that's exactly right. The thing is, when you become a gang member, you do enter into this process. And I'm sure at some earlier point in human evolution, it was functional. And there were good reasons for us to do this. But you form a pecking order and you designate both an internal and an external enemy. The internal enemy is he or she who is most ridiculed, who's at the bottom of your particular totem pole. And the external enemy is non-members of the group. And you reinforce among each other the ridicule of whoever those designated losers are.
Well, I've certainly seen, you know, nasty comments posted under articles or YouTube videos or whatever. But you point out in one chapter of your book that there have been people who literally have been hounded to death online.
Well, these are the more egregious examples. And unfortunately, there are some quite dramatic examples all over the world. Probably the most dramatic ones have actually been in Korea and more recently in China. But what concerns me much more is an ambient phenomenon like this. And here I'm going to turn to Facebook. What I have observed in speaking to a lot of Facebook users is that there is a generational divide, but it's exactly the reverse of the cliche. In fact, Facebook is a natural medium for older users. And by older, I don't mean, you know, retired. I just mean somebody who has a life already, somebody who has kids maybe, or somebody who has a job, somebody who's already invented an adult persona. And for someone like that, they use Facebook, they connect with old friends and whatnot, and it makes sense. What concerns me, however, is when I talk to younger people, say 16, 17, people who haven't yet had a chance to invent their adult persona, what I find with them is that, the way I'd put it, is they're acting out of fear instead of love. They're so concerned about what their online status is, and I mean status as in social status in a pecking order, that they have to conform very carefully. They're so worried about being ridiculed or falling out of favor. And then furthermore, Facebook is with them all the time. They have to tend to it constantly to make sure that nothing bad happens. And they don't get that wiggle room to experiment with alternate personas. Within that regime, you know, I don't think you could have, let's say, Bob Dylan's or Jack Kerouac's or Mark Twain's in that world, because you can't have the experience of just making up a new version of yourself and trying it on. You never get that breathing room, that moment. You have to just put all your effort into making sure that your official persona doesn't sink.
So can you play out how is it that technology itself, I mean, you're considered the father of virtual reality technology. You've been part of creating this technological world that we inhabit since the 80s. You know, the engineers and computer software experts who created all of this are your friends and your colleagues.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And remain so, and I'm still working in it. Absolutely.
So what is it about this world that you and your colleagues have created? What went wrong?
Well, a couple things happened. One thing was the rise of, I think, what's best described as a new religion, the digital religion, and it's sometimes called being a singularitarian, or sometimes it's called being a posthumanist. And it's this notion that people and machines are fundamentally the same, and the machines are becoming smart and conscious, and the people and the machines will merge into this big mush of super consciousness, something like that. And what's wrong with that is the way it causes us to change how we write software today. And a lot of these sort of mob-related software designs effectively are rituals to erase the reality of the individual people. It's quite a pervasive phenomenon. There's a whole university in Silicon Valley now called Singularity University where you can learn this theology. And the engineers who are enthusiastic about it have recreated all of the features of traditional religion. There's a rapture-like event when the computers will become smart and suck up the contents of our brains to give us eternal life. And there are all of these sorts of supernatural things that only true believers really have privy to. And it's very peculiar.
This is the idea of the singularity, that in the future humans and computers will merge to become kind of super smart,
right,
and live forever. So I take it you don't think this is going to happen?
No, I don't think computers exist independently of people. I don't think a computer is a real object in the sense that if you bash somebody's head with a computer, they will get a bump. So a computer's as real as a rock, but it's no more real than a rock. The patterns in a computer, which we understand as software, would be completely illegible and random to some alien who doesn't have our culture. So it's we who give reality to computers. They don't stand independently of us, and they can't become intelligent independently of us, my opinion. Obviously, that's a long debate. But
just to be clear, I mean, you're very critical of online digital culture these days, but you're not actually attacking the internet or the web. It's something more specific you're objecting to.
Right. No, I love the internet, and I think it's been a huge success and brings huge value to people, as has the web. It's really a rather thin layer that just came about since the turn of the century in the last decade, which is sometimes known as Web 2.0, that I'm criticizing.
And what is that? That's a current buzzword. What is Web 2.0?
It doesn't have an accepted precise definition, but the basic idea is that you design the internet so as to aggregate people into an illusion of a crowd that's doing the work so you can forget about the individuals, and then you're supposed to make money from selling advertisement instead of from rewarding people for what they do. And there's an advertising monopoly, so it basically accrues to one place, which is Google. Which, you know, is, I wish them well. They're friends, and I don't begrudge them their success at all. But essentially what it is it's a ritual of erasing individual humans to create the illusion that the internet itself is becoming alive.
How do we see this in our daily life? I guess I'm not necessarily aware that people have been erased when I'm going online.
Well, I'll give you a number of examples. One example is that a great many people listen to music that is chosen for them by an aggregate crowd algorithm, so that there's no longer a DJ. They don't know who the musicians are. They have no context for the music. They know nothing about the story of the musicians. And it starts to leach away the meaning of the music so that it becomes this sort of ambient phenomenon that might as well have come from a machine. And the ritual is that you're pretending that the crowd or the internet is becoming smart and choosing music for you, and that there's a danger, and it goes like this. Whenever you perceive the computer, be it the internet, choosing music for you, when you perceive the technology supposedly becoming smart or exercising judgment, you can't tell the degree to which you've made yourself stupid to bend over backwards to make it seem smart. Another example is all those algorithms that calculated credit risks and mortgages. And, you know, we have a boundless ability to make ourselves stupid in the face of algorithms that are supposed to be smart. And this notion that we can somehow give up ourselves, give up human responsibility and understanding, and that some smart computer will do better simply never works. And yet it's being presented to us again and again and again by technologists who want to erase the value of people because they're trying to elevate the value of technology in the service of this religion.
We've been talking, you know, kind of philosophically. Are there actual practical steps you would suggest people take if they are concerned about preserving their individuality, their personhood in the web-based world?
Yeah, I would say the number one thing you can do is think more about how you're using digital tools. So here are some examples. If you enjoy tweeting, if you like using Twitter, think about changing the mode once in a while. For instance, if you've been tweeting about external events, think about how to tweet about internal events. Can you tell people what your state of mind is in a way that's worth reading? That's a big challenge. I'm talking about poetry, basically, but give it a try. If you are mashing things up, if you're like grabbing YouTube videos and turning them into other videos, instead of just doing it in a sort of a light way where you don't really get to know where the video came from, contact the person who made it. Get to know them. Get into their experience. Make it your own so that what comes out is considered and has really come through you and isn't just a light mashup, but is one that's deep and really responds to the experience and the meaning of the original thing that you're mashing up. And if you're using Facebook, you know, create a few different personas and give yourself the room that you can try out different ones. It's very hard to do. Work really hard to invent yourself and fight against the digital technologies. Don't let them guide you. Don't take the easy route.
I'm curious, do you use Facebook or Twitter yourself?
No, I've decided not to use those. But of course, I have to have the experience of them to be able to talk about them. And my cat has graciously agreed to be my beta tester. And she's an avid user of them. But I will not reveal her identity.
Jaron Lanier has been a Silicon Valley visionary for the last three decades. He talked with Anne Strainchamps about his book, You Are Not a Gadget. Jaron Lanier is also a musician and composer with an abiding love for unusual instruments, especially the wind and string instruments of Asia. He's performed with artists as diverse as Philip Glass, Ornette Coleman, and Sean Lennon. You're listening to some of his music right now. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the show called Hive Mind, number 27B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. A special thanks to Leanne Sumner and to Freesound for our buzzing bees. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.